On Thursday, voters in England go to the polls to elect more than 2,600 councillors and 10 metro mayors in what will be the last set of local elections and mayoral contests before the general election. If things go very badly for the Tories, then Rishi Sunak's leadership will once again be called into question by a sizeable minority of Conservative MPs at Westminster. Welcome to the latest Downtown Den Politics Podcast.
Bigoted woman.
Me and my friend sort of used to run through the fields of wheat.
You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
It will cost.
I know words, I have the best words, but there's no better word than stupid.
Well, guess who is back? Yes, you will recall from last week's programme, I got a call right at the end of the programme from some bad men who had locked Jim Hancock in a room and were pleading with me. They will give me £5,500 if I came to release him. And so I dutifully went down to Plymouth and sorted that out. James was in good form, good spirits, and in all seriousness, Jim, you've been enjoying that triple lock of yours and had a good break by all accounts. Tell us what you've been up to for the last 3 weeks. We've missed you.
Very kind of you, partner. I've been all the way to Texas, the Lone Star State. I went over to see the total eclipse of the sun. We were told on the morning that there were going to be tornadoes and hailstorms, but God in his providence cleared the skies and we saw a magnificent 4-minute eclipse. And we went there because it was the maximum part of the United States where there was going to be a total eclipse. So I enjoyed that and indeed profited from my, I believe you made a remark about me using my triple lock pension, which I see the leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, has promised to renew. So yeah, we had a fabulous time. Visiting Texas. I'm not sure I would have done it otherwise. Most English people go to New York and Florida and California, but Texas is a fascinating place, fascinating history with this battle of the Spanish and the Mexicans, you know. So anyway, it's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, James. We have missed you. And as I say, I'm glad that Sakia has committed to that triple lock as well so that you can continue to live the high life, you and Fran. It's only right. Listen, before we turn into what are a very, very important set of local and mayoral election contests this week, because, of course, the implications are not simply who's going to be running your region or your local authority, but it is going to have an impact on the general election campaign, on the confidence of the political parties going into that campaign, of course. So we're going to delve into some of the detail of those contests in a moment. But this story that's emerging from Scotland, as we speak, the rumour is that the leader of the Scottish Parliament, First Minister, is considering resigning. Now, by the time this podcast goes live, he may well have fallen on his sword. But it's a remarkable fall from grace for the Scottish National Party, Jim. 17 years in power, Nicola Sturgeon, only 3 years ago, maybe even less than that, seemed to be probably the most powerful politician in the UK, had all before her, was talking about going back to the Scottish people with another referendum for independence. Since that time, it's all fallen apart. She resigned on the back of her resignation. There were a flurry of arrests from Scottish National Party members, including Nicola Sturgeon's husband, who's the chief executive of the party at one time. There are all sorts of allegations flying about in terms of misuse of funds. And now the new leader has lost the confidence of the Green Party, or last week he actually sacked the Green Party. I'm not quite sure what happened there. I'm not sure who fell out with who and whether the Greens were sort of pushed before they jumped. But what do you make of all this? Because as I say, it's been an incredible fall from grace, hasn't it, for the SNP?
Yes, I think you rightly
outlined all the events. And I think we do have to go back to the supremacy of Nicola Sturgeon for years to see the seeds of where we are today, because she was a commanding figure and shut down any dissent that there was in the SNP. I mean, for a long time, we thought, why did you never hear any dissenting voices? And she clearly had a stranglehold on her own party and was not a great cooperator with other parties. And all that's now coming back to haunt the SNP because the other parties see an opportunity to not support them. It does seem incredible that last Tuesday, Hamza Yousaf was saying that his deal with the Greens was like sterling gold, and then 2 days later sacked them. And then writes a letter on Saturday pleading for their support in the no confidence vote. I think what's happened here, I mean, I think we were all a bit curious as to how, quite apart from all the other issues that the SNP faced, they did become mired in this gender politics, the question of trans rights, things like that. And that was the Green influence in the coalition. The Greens were pushing their agenda, and the SNP, I think, there is a conservative wing of the SNP. I mean, let's not forget that the SNP began as a fairly right-wing nationalist organisation and only adopted a sort of social wing later on. And I think some of those people slightly resented that sort of social programme and also felt that it was distracting from the cause of Scottish nationalism. So I think there was that tension when Hamza Yousaf decided to ditch his partners without realising his vulnerability. I mean, to be in the position of having to ask for the one vote of the woman that he beat in the leadership election, who then went off and joined Alex Salmond's Alba Party, again, is beyond parody. And how interesting it is, Frank, to see Alex Salmond back on the television, you know, obviously enjoying every moment of it. I remember Alex Salmond coming to Liverpool once, I think, for one of our events. And I said, could we possibly redraw the border and go in with your leadership? I've always had a soft spot for him but of course he fell out spectacularly with Nicola Sturgeon and formed this other party. And his agenda is, I think, wrong. I don't think he can get anywhere, but his agenda is to have a much more aggressive policy on independence. But, you know, Nicola Sturgeon, to be fair to her, exhausted all the constitutional possibilities. So it's a very long answer, but I mean, obviously this sort of plays into the hand of Labour, who are hoping to pick up a lot of seats in Scotland. And I imagine this continuing disarray in the probability that the SNP will have to elect a new leader plays into Keir Starmer's hands.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing to reflect upon, though, is how long can you keep this coalition together? I'm not talking about the coalition with the Greens or other political parties. I'm talking about that SNP coalition that you referred to. You do have some very conservative voices within the Scottish National Party. Indeed, there's a woman called Forbes who has, I would suggest, you know, quite a right-wing agenda, who came quite close to beating the leader. What's that? I always get this guy's name. Hamza Yousaf, yeah. So she came very close, didn't she, to beating Yousaf. And, you know, that was partly to do with the issue that you raised, transgender rights. But when you take away the possibility of independence, or it looks, you know, at least 10, if not 15 years away, what does gel those people together? And the answer is not very much, actually. And if you compare and contrast, you know, 17 years as well, so in a long time, the sort of old adage, you know, power corrupts, comes to the fore, and some of the allegations, as I say, not going away. I think Sturgeon's husband was rearrested recently, charged, I think, even. So, you know, the SNP sort of fallen apart. Not dissimilarly to what's happening to the Conservative Party in Westminster, because, you know, 14 years in charge, the big push for many of them was Brexit, get us out of the EU. That hasn't quite delivered things that the sunlit uplands that they promised. And so you've got all these right wingers within that parliamentary party flailing about looking for an agenda that they can't quite agree upon. You got Sunak trying to hold the whole thing together. Again, a coalition within the Conservative Party, the five families and all the rest of it, that is struggling. I just think there's two things, isn't there, Jim? Firstly, if you're in power too long, then you are likely to have these problems, these dramas occur. But secondly, it's a reminder that all of our political parties tend to be coalitions of some sort.
Yeah. They do, because of the voting system. Of course, that's less true in Scotland. It was just that the incredible success of the SNP did lead to them having a majority, which was never intended in the way in which the Scottish Parliament was elected. So they have these additional members, and it's meant to lead to power sharing. But obviously, as we previously discussed in England, this first-past-the-post system, in the United Kingdom's first-past-the-post system, prevents us having at least four parties: a socialist Corbynite Labour Party or Socialist Party, the sort of centre-left Social Democratic Party that Sir Keir Starmer and Wes Streeting represent, a centre-right Conservative Party represented by Damian Green and people like that, who are actually probably pro-Europe and liberal on social values, but more conservative on economic values. And then, and we've got it forming before our very eyes, with a Fern Party, which appeals to Nigel Farage and indeed people like Liz Truss. And you'd have that choice for the British people and which means as well. So, but because we have this system, people stay within the same party who have no love for each other at all.
And you do wonder whether electoral form is almost becoming an inevitable consequence of these dramatic splits that are taking place within two political parties that, in general terms, certainly for the past two decades, would see power as being inevitable for them. You know, the Tories usually take power, but if they split between Reform and the Conservative Party, I've seen two scenarios suggested, Jim, and I'd like to get your take on this, actually. One is that the Tory party totally splits. Suella Braverman joins Reform, which is something that Joe Phillips is predicting, before the next election. And then they go the separate ways, and some people from the right of the Conservative Party go off and join Reform, and leaving those socially minded One Nation Conservatives, I suppose we describe them as, where they are. The other thing that's being suggested, though, is that Nigel Farage is on manoeuvres, and actually what he sees is a Trumpian takeover of the Conservative Party, with him leading the charge, and the Conservative Party morphs into a far more right-wing entity. Of those two options, which do you think is the most realistic?
I think, you know, simply because the Conservative Party always seems to stay together one way or the other, Farage coming into the Conservative Party is more likely than a formal split. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. It depends partly on the size of the defeat. I mean, if they're hammered and get less than 100 votes, as was forecast in the downtown event that we both attended last week, there might be a feeling that the game's up and they might as well split. I think it's more likely that Farage and Braverman and Truss will try and reshape the Conservative Party. The problem with electoral reform is I don't think either party will do it, because when they're in office, they think they're going to win office. And so I don't see, it'd be interesting to talk to Wes Streeting about this. I can't see him supporting electoral reform. I know you always I'm amused when I raise the spectre of the Liberal Democrats, but I will do so on this occasion. It would be only if they were in like a 2010 situation and actually played their hand with far more vigour and made it a condition without referendum to change the voting system. That's the only way I see the voting system being changed.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen this time, but the one after, who knows, because Labour are going to inherit, as we've discussed previously, you know, a right old mess. But let me just stick with this scenario, you're saying that more likely Farage comes in, works with Braverman and Truss to try and take the Conservative Party firmly to the right. Where does that leave people like Gillian Keegan, Michael Heseltine, Ken Clark, others within the Parliamentary Conservative Party? Would they be comfortable staying within an organisation such as that one?
Well, I mean, obviously Ken Clark and Michael Heseltine are in the sort of...
are they in the wilderness already? They were banished by Boris, weren't they?
Yes, and they're in the, without putting too fine a point on it, and at my age, I need to be careful with this, sort of in the departure land. it's more
than you've got. You have got people like Damien Green, for example.
Yes, that's
There are an awful lot of Conservative MPs still who we would consider One Nation Conservatives, and so a Farage takeover of the Conservative Party, where does that leave them?
Well, Wes Streeting yesterday on television was actually saying, in relation to this doctor who's joined them, that he's very relaxed about other people joining. His argument is that the problems of the nation are so great that it's going to take a broad approach by an incoming Labour government to solve these problems. And he was reaching, I thought it was quite a statesmanlike comment to make, actually. He was reaching out saying, we are not, Corbyn and people like that would be very uptight about taking Tories on board. But he's seems to be quite relaxed about it. Now, I'm not saying at this stage that Damien Green would contemplate joining the Labour Party, but, if his party was changed out of rule recognition, anything is possible.
I suppose you've mentioned Jeremy Corbyn there, and people like me who were uncomfortable with Corbyn's leadership and policies. We stayed within the Labour Party, I suppose we'd say, to fight. But many did leave, and have since returned, of course, but many did leave. My fear, though, with a very populist Conservative Party is that they are successful in a way in which, in this country, a left-wing Corbyn-led political organisation was never going to be successful. And so if Farage starts to get some traction, or Braverman, whoever was the leader, then, of course, the Conservative Party, which loves winning more than anything else, it seems to me, does sort of put up with that style of politics in order to return to power. Because, as I say, right-wing populism has a more opportunity of winning votes in this country than, as I say, a left-wing political party, in my view.
No, I absolutely agree with you. It's a very profound point, actually, because in many ways, what Tyson, people like that in the form, are actually suggesting, which is, as I understand it, detention camps for immigrants. That's how he would want to solve the immigration crisis. There was more of an appetite for that than there ever is for a sort of Marxist Britain. And that is a profound point. I mean, and we actually see that in the media as well. You see far more, and here and in America, you see lots of radio stations, shock jocks on the right, far less on the left. And that's because there isn't an appetite to hear it, I presume, especially in the commercial world of the United States. So, yes, I mean, that's always the choice for the Damien Greens of this world. They see power returning. I mean, a lot of it will depend on the first couple of years of the Labour government. I mean, if they are able to get on top of things and start to achieve things, a second term will look in prospect. And I do fear this a little, they are just weighed down with the same problems.
Yeah.
Are reluctant to take some of the tough decisions because of a kind heart. Some people are already saying to me that we actually need some tough stances on things like people getting back to work with mental instability. We've seen a minister on this morning talking about that. You can see the Tories will go into the election saying we need a tougher approach on this. The Labour government's unlikely to be, is likely to be reluctant to take that view, And so if it all starts to founder after a couple of years, then there's momentum going on within the Tories. But a lot will depend on how decimated they are and what immediately happens.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's an interesting point as well that you make, and it was one that was echoed by Martin Littross on Wednesday. I don't know if you recall his comment. We did this event with Naomi Smith, who's the chief executive of Best for Britain. It was on the podcast a few weeks ago, I think during your 6 or 7 week absence, James, whilst you were spending your trip a lot. And Martin was saying on Wednesday afternoon, when we had that fascinating conversation with Naomi, the problem that the left had is it makes quite simple issues very complex and complicated. And the right make complex issues quite simple with sound bites. You know, Take Back Control is a great example of that, isn't it, in terms of the Brexit referendum, for example. And I think he's onto something there, Martin, isn't he? You know, Labour and its messaging is always seems to be more convoluted and reasonable in a sense, when people out there, particularly in 2024, simply don't have the time to listen, or the inclination for that matter. They want the soundbite, they want the simple solutions. And although it drives us to frustration, those of us who study what the issues are, study what these challenges are, you know, the idea that Labour are going to be able to come up with a set of very simple soundbites, I think it's going to be difficult, certainly between now and the general election. Then, as you say, subsequently, they do take government. They are inheriting this huge mess. And my fear, I think, is that because we've been scared to be honest with the British people about how big those challenges are, and we simply keep saying, well, we'll just manage all this mess better than that lot, then people are not going to give you the leeway than perhaps you are going to need in that first period of government.
How about Labour's slogan in the election being "Get Britain Fixed"?
Yeah, that's a great slogan. It's a good slogan. Yeah, it's a good slogan.
And you know, you're absolutely right. So my advice would be, go into the election under the slogan of "Get Britain Fixed." Very early on, make a prime ministerial statement levelling with the British people about the state of the problems, and say what you're going to do about it, and get on with it in the first year of your administration when you are strongest. That would be my recommendation. And then, you know, it might fail, but you have the best chance early on, and then it might succeed, and then you're cooking on gas.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that you've got to have some sympathy with the Labour leadership, because I always reflect on messaging and how you can maintain this poll lead and the Ming Vars strategy, as we've often discussed on this podcast previously. And I think back to that film, All Good Men. I don't know if you remember that. It's a film about, there's a conflict in the Middle East, and there's an American general in charge of the troops, and he makes an order that it all goes wrong, and he's up on a court-martial, he's in the dock, and he says, "The truth, you couldn't handle the truth." And I do sense that the British people, simply at this moment in time, are not in any mood to hear the truth. So all the polls, we want more spending on the NHS. We want immigrants to be sent back home. We want more money spent on defence. We want our schools fixed. We want more money spent on social care. You start to unravel that. Oh, and by the way, we're taxed too much as it is. So you start to unwind that. You say, well, how do you think we're going to get more money into the NHS if you don't pay more tax? Actually, what you need in the NHS, in my view, is reform rather than more spending, but that's another debate. Then you look at the immigration issue. You say, well, how do you think we're going to fix the economy? And social care in particular is an area where we're suffering as far as this is concerned, if you don't allow immigration, because without immigrants, your social care system is going to be bust for an awfully long time. How do you deal with this issue that we have in the longer term, aging population and people having fewer kids? Are we just going to allow the population of the UK to totally decline, not letting anybody in? And then this idea that we spend more on defence, not a particularly popular policy, Jim. And yet the world is becoming a more dangerous place. So that line that was delivered in that film, as I say, All Good Men, "The truth, you can't handle the truth," seems to me to be a problem, not just for the politicians, but for the British public generally.
Well, I think the situation is so serious that a speech along the lines that you've made should be made. It is high-risk politics, but if it delivers, you know, if Labour then does perhaps raise taxes and certainly does reform the NHS and gets some with it, then, you know, at least they've tried. I mean, if they just muddle along. I mean, let's just take a particular example. I mean, we're having more rail strikes in next week. And it's because the rail unions, or ASLEF in particular, won't accept change in working practices. And although the reporting on this is always very poor, the main change in working practices that the management of the railways want is for them to be rested on Sundays, Saturdays and Sundays at weekends, instead of having to volunteer for it. That seems to me to be wholly reasonable, actually. And we can argue about how much pay they've been offered, but that seems a wholly reasonable demand by the management. Now, it's not happened under a Tory government. Do we seriously think that a Labour transport secretary is going to be tougher on that? And that's the danger, you know, that Labour won't grasp that nettle. I'm obviously being idealistic here. You're right. No one's going to make the sort of eloquent speech that you've just done, spelling out the actual truths of things, I suppose. It's a shame, though, because we told people aren't stupid. What's stupid about the things that you said? Nothing. It's pretty straightforward. And you say it with a warm heart, a charitable person, someone on the left who wants the social care, who wants a good health service. But you're also realistic about it. And if the British people couldn't take a speech, having elected a government, I mean, obviously it depends on the size, but say Labour win with a stonking majority, you know, a Labour Prime Minister will have great authority to make the sort of speech you've made. But, you know, I'm probably being completely idealistic.
No, well, I think that is the opportunity, isn't it? The opportunity comes post-election rather than pre-election. And I do think that Prime Minister Starmer would have to be very quickly upfront with the British public. Otherwise, you can see it all unravelling, because there is no magic wand to resolve some of the massive issues that, unfortunately, the UK faces at this moment in time. And, by the way, we haven't even talked about Europe, because, again, the quick wins that any pragmatic government, whether it be Labour or Tory, could take if they were to just have a mature conversation with our European partners, totally outstrips any of the fantasy benefits that were promised by the clown Johnson and his colleagues during the referendum campaign. Final thing I'll do before we go to the break, if I may, Jim, and we'll talk about the very important local elections that are happening on Thursday. You mentioned Alex Salmond in terms of his sort of come back into the fray, and he's set up this new political party in Scotland, the Alba Party. I've mentioned Nigel Farage, and of course, very recently, we were talking about George Galloway, who won that by-election in Rochdale. Bloody hell, it's the return of the living dead, isn't it, Jim? And again, on a serious note, are we concerned that we're not seeing those big political figures coming through the ranks as we did in the past? I mean, you've referenced several times this morning Wes Streeting. Beyond Wes, genuinely, I am really struggling to see young up-and-coming politicians across that political spectrum who have got that stardust, that star quality. I'm not suggesting that there are not really good, talented people within both the Labour and Conservative parties, and indeed other political parties as well. But when you consider those three names, Farage, Galloway, Salmond, I mean, I don't know what the cumulative age of those three is, but it must be approaching about 500. And they're all making political comeback. Is that unusual, Jim? You know, given your experience in the political field, was there ever another time when you've seen these figures sort of emerge from almost political obscurity back into the middle of the fray?
It is difficult to see this next generation. I mean, I need to try to really think about your interesting question. It strikes me that Tracy Braben, who's the mayor of West Yorkshire, is a rising star in the Labour Party, in on the West Streeting situation. I think Claire Coutinho in the Conservative Party.
Yes, he's good.
She's not mentioned amongst the bevy of women actually going for leadership. She might emerge, but you know, this really goes to the problem that we've got, you know, that one thinks, you know, and trying to discount the first of any older commentator that I always sort of think it was a golden age, and I'm thrilling myself. But, you know, the social media and the disinclination to enter politics has robbed us of a generation of really brilliant people. I think, you know, we've been so low in this meat grinder of COVID and Brexit and so on that it's sort of prevented the emergence of people. I mean, Dan Poulter, for instance, you know, I mean, I'm surprised he's retiring from Parliament, actually.
Standing down, yeah.
Yeah, people like that, you know, they've done something else in life. Comes through. But I'll do some thinking about this, and maybe we can return to this next week, because I'm sure we could identify some people, but there isn't the proliferation of them, and we're, you know, probably like the United States, aren't we? We're sort of going back to the past.
Right? Well, that was the thing that was striking, actually, was I was listening to something about the American presidential contest yesterday, and you know, you think Biden, Trump, and we sort of laughed, didn't we, at the Yanks? And then when we've been discussing our politics this morning, it all of a sudden came to me, well, we've got these three bloody aging clowns all coming back into the middle of the discussion and debate. As I say, Farage, who arguably delivered the, well, not even arguably, you know, he delivered the biggest political success of the 21st century so far for the right. He's been the most influential character in terms of being able to force a referendum and then help win that referendum in terms of Brexit. Galloway, you know, how he's ended up back in Parliament is beyond my comprehension, to be honest. And then as say, Alex Salmond, he was, again, 20 years ago, when Alex Salmond's career would have been finished. Whether he was guilty or not of some of the things that he was accused of, the fact of the matter is that at one point in politics, once that sort of sniff and smell of scandal started to surround you as a personality, you were gone. Seems to me now you're able to brush it under the carpet and come on back.
Yes, I think Farage is, I think he's only just turned 60, actually.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. He's in a different category from
he just other. Looks a lot older, doesn't he?
I would discount Galloway and Salmond. Galloway has always profited, or he's done it successively, on a very narrow base on the right seats that absolutely suit him. And I think he has a very narrow path in success and won't be very influential, although he will be in these local elections, which should have something big. Alex Salmond, I mean, it clearly the SNP regard him as anathema. I don't, you know, his Alba Party hasn't actually won any elections. The only reason they've got a seat is because somebody defected. So I think of the three, Farage is the one to is really a valid entry.
Yeah, as I say, I just think it's strange that those three are still dominating the headlines from time to time, and you know, it's one level, somebody who's sort of entering the twilight of their career as I am, it's I suppose I could be optimistic about it. But as another, I do think, oh, you know, where are the sort of young Tony Blairs and the Gordon Browns and those sort of, and even the Cameron and the Osborne, you know, if I was to stretch it to the Conservative side, it just doesn't appear to me that we've got those calibre of people come through. But we'll go off and do a bit of research, Jim. I'm sure they're out there. Perhaps they just don't get the media airtime that they're deserving at the moment. Listen, we're going to take a short break. We've spent far longer on that particular segment of the discussion than I anticipated, but it's been such an interesting one. And it's so good to hear your dulcet tones again after your long, long break, Jim. So listen, stay back. We won't be taking a long, long break. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, Hi, I'm Frank McKenna, the Chief Executive and Group Chairman of Downtown in Business, and we are currently taking votes for the City of Liverpool Business Awards, the City of Manchester Business Awards, and the City of Birmingham Business Awards. So if you want to vote for your favourites, please go to our website, all the W's, downtowninbusiness.com. Vote for the company or the individual who you think is deserving of a business award in 2024, and find out all the details of how you can get a seat at those three great events. So that's the City of Liverpool Business Award on the 4th of July at Sefton Park Palm House. And then in the autumn, we're at the Lowry for the Manchester event, and we're at Bank, the fantastic restaurant in Birmingham, for the City of Birmingham Business Award. So get voting, get booking your tickets, and we look forward to celebrating with all those fantastic winners when those awards events come around.
Welcome back to the second part of the Downtown Den Politics podcast. I'm delighted to be rejoined this week by my partner in crime, Jim Hancock. I'm, of course, Frank McKenna, the Chief Executive and Group Chair of Downtown in Business. Now, at the top of the show, I mentioned the crucial local election, the mayoral contest that are happening on Thursday. I would simply say, not trying to influence how you vote in those polls, but you should vote. And if you are going to the polling station, do not forget to take your voter ID. An awful lot of people did forget that last set of elections where this particular rule was in place, and you will be turned away. And likely other you're going home and coming back to the polling station, unlikely. So please do take some voter ID with you on Thursday if you're voting. Now, James, this is seen as a critical test of Rishi Sunak's premiership. Labour are anticipated to win up to about 500 local authority council seats. Tory party only defending 18 councils that they currently run from this set of elections. So they're not going to lose control of lots and lots of councils. But then you've got these very high-profile mayoral contests as well happening across the country. So let's start with the local council elections first. 500 seats. That sounds to me it's about half of what the Conservatives won in the subsequent elections 4 years ago. Sounds to me as though that's a little bit of crisis management for the Tory side. That seems like a very optimistic number for Labour to win.
Yes, but I think they might do it. I mean, there is talk of a repeat of 1995 when the Conservatives were in deep trouble over Europe under John Major, and they lost every council in the north of England, even lost control of Macclesfield. And so these election seats were last fought in 2021, when actually Boris Johnson was pretty popular and won the Hartlepool by-election, which nearly led to Keir Starmer terminating his leadership very promptly. So they do have quite a lot of seats up which could be taken. So I do expect substantial Labour gains. But as you rightly say, with council elections, because a lot of them are elected in thirds, the sort of transition from one to another party is almost restricted. So the interpretation of the results will be influenced something like that. I mean, the Conservatives will obviously clutch at any straws, and that's why the mayoral elections in the West Midlands and in Tees Valley are absolutely crucial. In the West Midlands, we have Andy Street on a pretty narrow majority, a man who's wearing his Conservative credentials unlikely, to say the least. We all remember in the Manchester Hotel last October, he nearly resigned over the scrapping of HS2. And then in the northeast, we have this intriguing figure, Ben Houchin, who won Tees Valley in a bit of a shock 2 terms ago, and then won by a landslide last time. He's been embroiled in this controversy over the redevelopment of the steelworks out in Tees Valley. But if one or both of those could hold on, you can imagine the Conservatives would ignore every other result and just really play on that. So those two elections are absolutely crucial.
Yeah, and the Conservatives in the past have been good at spinning really poor local election results. I think somebody was reminding me, Cecil Parkinson, 1991, I think I'm right in saying, chairman of the Tory party at the time, and they managed to hold on to Wandsworth, which wasn't a particularly massive result for the Tories, but he made out that it was, and of course they got the headlines, and that's what these elections on Thursday, to an extent, are about. You know, it's who can spin the result to favour their own political party and their own political messaging best. And like you, Jim, I think that the Tories will be hoping beyond hope, that, or Rishi Sunak at least will be hoping beyond hope, that Andy Street in the West Midlands, who I think has done a terrific job, whatever your politics, I think it's, you'd be hard-pressed to say with a straight face that Andy Street hasn't delivered some really good things for the West Midlands, including in part, of course, the Commonwealth Games. I know it wasn't all Andy Street's doing, but he certainly was a significant player as far as that event was concerned. And then in Tees Valley, as you say, this big character, Ben Houchet, I think a bit of a Marmite figure, probably locally as well as nationally, has got this big controversy hanging over him over land deals, was elevated to the Lords, of course, by Boris Johnson. So if he does lose his seat on Thursday, he's certainly not out of politics. Maybe he's one of these young up-and-coming Tory stars that we should be keeping an eye on, actually. But those two contests, crucial for the Conservatives. And as you say, Jim, if they hold both or either one of them, then the story of the night from Conservative central office is going to be, it's not all over for Rishi Sunak. It's not all over for the government. Look what we've done in these key areas of the West Midlands and the North East. We can still have one final push and hang on.
Yes, just to finish off on the mayors. I mean, I have been struck, actually, to be fair to the BBC, they have done a lot of...
Good job.
There have been debates, and we've actually heard the issues that I've been particularly focusing on, the ones in the Northwest, where we can't expect any surprises with Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester, or Steve Rotherham in the Liverpool City region. But we've also got Sadiq Khan in London, whom the Tory press have really been sticking the knife into, literally over knife crime and things like that. And there are suggestions that the Conservative candidate, a woman in London, is actually doing slightly better than was anticipated. But I imagine that Carl Mooney, to some extent, and we'll come on to talk about this in other contexts as well, slightly affected by the Gaza controversy. But we would expect those, you know, Rotherham, Burnham and Khan to be re-elected. But it does sort of vindicate, I mean, as you know, I'm a regionalist rather than a city person, but I have to acknowledge that having these mayoral contests does allow a sub-regional debate about the real issues. And, you know, places like Lancashire, who've turned their back on the model, need to reflect on that, because we've not had the debate about Lancashire, which we might have had if there'd been a Lancashire mayor. I don't know what you feel about that.
Yeah, I think that what I'm noticing in terms of these elections is much higher profile in terms of the interest that's been demonstrated by the media in particular, but people are now starting to recognise these personalities and these names, you know, Andy Burnham, Ben Houchen, Andy Street, Steve Rotherham, Tracy Braben. You know, the man and woman in the street might not be a fay with all of those people, but I tell you what, I think there's more name recognition of our regional mayors than there are of our MPs. You ask most people who their constituency MP is and they're struggling to tell you. I think if you go to people in Liverpool and you say Steve Rotherham, people know who he is. So I think that's starting to make a positive impact on our politics. And actually, if I take my tribalism out of the polls on Thursday, then you would also say a victory for Andy Street in particular would be good news and demonstrate again a maturity of our politics now, where people aren't necessarily simply going to the polls on local election day and putting the cross next to the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, but they're actually thinking about the job that personality is doing. And that seldom happens, sadly, with the local authority leader. And I was saying a couple of weeks ago, actually, Jim, that one of the frustrating things as a local authority member was that you were always biting your nails in terms of the cycle of your local election. So even if you were performing supremely well as a local authority, as Lancashire County Council did, and you know this, for many, many years, if we'd have fallen on an election day, which was sort of bang in the middle of a Labour government who were going through a bit of a tough time, didn't matter how good a job we were doing, we'd be out on our ear. And conversely, if we'd have been doing a lousy job, if the Conservative Party were having a tough time and they were in government, we'd benefit from that as well. But this idea that people are actually going to the polls and voting on local and regional issues, I think is great news and wind in the sails for people like you and I, Jim, who've been arguing for devolution for years.
My example goes back a long way to 1977. The Greater Manchester Council had been created under the leadership of a man called Sir Robert Thomas, who was an excellent, who was Labour, but he'd moved from the City Council to the County Council. He was not very popular with some of his Manchester Labour colleagues, but he did a good job in founding the Greater Manchester Council. But 1977, in the middle of Mr Callaghan had just taken over as Labour leader, very unpopular, and Sir Robert Thomas was swept aside by the Conservatives taking control of the Greater Manchester Council under the leadership of Arnold Fieldhouse. He was a classic Tory with a pinstripe suit, real creamed hair, and smoked cigars. And he took over. And it was no reflection on what Sir Robert had done, but it was exactly what you say. It was just the tide that carried him out.
Yeah. So if we get to that point where people are genuinely going to the polls voting for the personality, the mayor, then, as I say, I think, you know, that whole model of devolution just gains greater momentum. I don't think there's any way in which you can put that genie back in the bottle now, and that's great news. There's a couple of other things I just want to pick up on in terms of the mayoralties. It's an interesting contest happening in York and North Yorkshire because that includes the constituency of the Prime Minister. And again, if we were in a position where it was sort of level playing field, you know, 50-50, you would guess that that particular mayoralty would go Tory. Looks as though that's going to be a Labour victory. That could cause Sunak some sort of local embarrassment, I suppose. That's one to keep an eye on because it's not a shoo-in for Labour, that. And you've mentioned the London contest and sort of dismissed the Tory candidate a little there in terms of saying, well, you know, Sadiq Khan, despite all of his trials and tribulations, will get elected. I think that's going to be a lot tighter. And again, the Tories will make great play of that. You know, if there is a close contest in London, a city, our capital is seen as very Labour orientated, voted to remain, lots and lots of Labour MPs there, despite the fact that you have huge landslide for the Tory party last time. The Tories will be hanging on to that as well. I have to say, I do wonder whether Sunak sometimes regrets not standing a more serious candidate against Sadiq Khan, because somebody like Paul Scully, who was Minister for London for some time, standing down, sadly, another one that we're losing at the next election, talented Conservative MP, but was told by the whips, no, you're not allowed to go for the mayoralty because we do not need another by-election in a parliamentary seat. As I say, I do wonder whether Sunak is shaking his head thinking that was a mistake now, because I think somebody like Paul Scully would have really made it squeaky bum time for Sadiq Khan, Jim.
Yes, yeah. As we know, you know, when Boris Johnson was a big figure and was able to actually win. So,
Against a popular character, don't you? This is the difference. Yes. You know, whatever your politics are and whatever you think of the jobs Sadiq Khan has or hasn't done, the point that you made there, he's been, not just during this election campaign, but for many, many years now, he has been one of the figures within the Labour Party who the press have gone after. Whole range of issues. You know, the disgraceful comment that Lee Anderson made a few weeks ago that eventually led to Anderson resigning from the Conservative Party and joining Reform, of course. But, you know, knife crime, another one. ULEZ, another big issue that they've gone after Khan over. They're even blaming Sadiq Khan now for some of the ramifications of the two things that he had absolutely zero to do with. One, the pandemic. So work from home and the nightlife and the sort of hospitality and visitor economy in London has suffered. And of course, the other reason that that particular sector is suffering is because of Brexit. But they're all saying, oh, London's not as lively a place now. It's all Sadiq Khan's fault. But they've really gone after him, Jim. And as I say, I think if they'd have stood a much better candidate against him, then he could have been in even more trouble than he is. I think that's going to be a tight race. It's going to be one I'll be keeping an eye on Thursday for sure.
Well, that's interesting, because we've sort of identified a hope, not necessarily an expectation, that people in these mayoral contests will actually think about who they're voting for rather than who they're going to vote for in the general election. But we need to have a word about all the other elections. I mean, including, of course, a by-election in Blackpool South.
Absolutely, a parliamentary by-election. That's right.
Where one would expect, you know, because the outgoing disgraced Tory MP has a smaller majority than some of the seats that have easily gone to Labour in the past. I think it's an almost fighting certainty that Labour will take Blackpool South. And they will also be hoping to sort of consolidate their position in places in Lancashire. But we need to point out that the Gaza crisis will be an influential factor in places like Blackburn and Burnley and in other parts of the West Midlands and so on, where there are candidates standing who will work, Labour councillors who reside, who are standing on the Gaza issue, and that will have a local effect in certain wards. So we need to bear that in mind. And the only thing to say about the Liberal Democrats, which I do insist on mentioning, the only place where there's any real interest in hoping to win one or two councils in the south of England around London, but in the northwest, Stockport, where they haven't got an overall majority, they wiped out the Tories. But I think they will still fail to actually secure overall control of Stockport, but that's an important place in relation to the parliamentary constituencies of Hazelgrove and Cheadle nearby. So there's quite a lot to look at.
Well, let me get some brownie points with you, Jim, and our Liberal Democrat listener, and tell you that the council that they are really targeting this time around is Dorset Council, which is not far from your neck of the woods down in Plymouth, is it?
It's quite a long way, but you always make the mistake of all people north of the Trent in thinking that places like Portsmouth and Plymouth are 5 miles apart.
Only doing what you buggers in the south do to the north, who all think that Liverpool and Newcastle are about 5 minutes away from each other. But no, the Liberal Democrats, you know, if they follow this strategy of targeting particular areas, particular seats, Dorset is the one, I'm told, which is the bellwether council for them, because this will prove or disprove this tactic that they've adopted, this strategy of let's go after a small number of seats. They've got limited resources. We understand and appreciate that. And if they win Dorset, they would see that as big justification for that strategy, James. So Dorset is the one to keep an eye on if you are looking to see how the Liberal Democrats are performing. Are you impressed with my research on that particular?
I'm extremely impressed. The land of hardy, the hardy country, far from the madding crowd. I've been told by quite a senior contact of mine in the Liberal Democrats that when it comes to the general election, they are virtually, apart from places like Westmorland and Hazelgrove, they're virtually going to not campaign in the north of England. They're going to concentrate on the south of England, the southwest, and around London. The Blue Wall, yeah.
The Blue Wall. And that Blackpool seat, by the way, Labour's candidate, this guy called Chris Webb, who I know very well. And politics aside, again, we talked about, you know, I feel as though I can say this, given the fact that I've heaped some praise on Andy Street this morning. Chris Webb will be an absolutely outstanding constituency MP for Blackpool. Really, really good guy. And I think he's contested the seat previously, I think. But he's certainly going to be a person who goes into Parliament and backed hard for Blackpool because he's a Blackpool lad as well. So I think that is good news for Blackpool, whatever, again, as I say, what your party politics are. So I think in summary, Jim, we'd be saying we expect some big gains for Labour. As I say, the prediction is up to 500. I'd be surprised if it gets that high in terms of seats. Local authorities lost by the Tories. They've only got 18 to lose. You've made the point. It's a third of councillors in those councils that are up for election. So they may hang on to some local authorities. And the mayoral contest to really keep an eye on, we would suggest, are Tees Valley and the West Midlands, but with half an eye on London to see, again, we would probably say to see what the margin of Sadiq Khan's victory is there. And the sort of outside bet for me in terms of having a look at on Thursday evening, Friday morning, would be that York and North Yorkshire mayoralty as well. So yeah, some very, very interesting contests to be had on Thursday. And then the ramifications.
It's always complicated because there are all-out elections in Warrington this time. And we also need to mention there are no elections in Liverpool because people in Liverpool have been used to elections every
not
year.
Not in Birmingham either. I mean, the issue in terms of Steve Rotherham and Andy Street, Steve Rotherham's case, probably a disadvantage that Liverpool don't have local elections on the same day. In Andy Street's case, it's probably good news that the residents of Birmingham are not going out to vote for their local council election. So if they're going to go out and vote at all, it's for the mayoral contest. Birmingham, again, you'd have to caveat this with the fact that the city council's been in some serious trouble. It's gone bankrupt. So there might have been a backlash of Birmingham voters against the Labour Party in these contests. And then you've got that Gaza issue thrown into the mix as well, with a big Muslim vote for Labour usually in Birmingham. So, yeah, Birmingham not voting this time round as a city council, Liverpool City Council not voting. So that may have a bit of an impact on those two mayoral votes, but not much, I wouldn't have thought. And then, as I say, Jim, it's what the fallout is going to be, isn't it? Because we look at these local elections, you and I, again, will be keenly aware of local authorities and the Northwest in particular, in your case, and me a little further afield, of leaders who we admire, performing good performing councils who we see, basically good politicians, good local politicians losing their seats because of the performance of their national parties. But if the Tories, worst case scenario, he loses the West Midlands, he loses Tees Valley, he loses 500 seats. Does Sunak survive?
I think so. If he loses Howcham as well, you know, there will be uproar on the right of the party. There will be thoughts about what do we do about this? Do we make another change? But you know, it's just the spectacle of a further leadership change. I think they'll hobble on. There will be a question about whether to rip the plaster off and just get on with it, with the view that, you know, going through the summer, things might improve, but things could get even worse. But my instinct is still that Starmer will, that Sunak will try and say, we baked this in. We knew we were going to get a bad result. There was a phrase being used yesterday by a Tory spokesman that the electorate's grumpy, but expressing grumpiness in the local elections is different from deciding on who you want to govern for the next 5 years. So I think he will survive. I think there'll be quite a lot of murmuring and all that sort of thing. It will be a very unhappy time for him. But I think he'll survive. I think he'll hope that the economy improves during the summer. I think he'll hope to get these flights off to Rwanda. I mean, we haven't had a chance to talk about that today, but we're now beginning to realise what's involved. I mean, the Scottish police apparently have been put on alert for people who are going in for asylum hearings, who will be detained prior to being flown away. So we're beginning to see the reality of this now, and how the actual extraction of people, putting them on the planes. We're talking about...
Let's not get into Rwanda, Jim. We'll do that next week if we may. We just need to know what the impact of the local election campaign was. And you've taken me into a whole new programme. I mean, Rwanda's bloody half an hour discussion, not 5 minutes at the end of the podcast.
I think he'll survive the local elections, however disastrous, and we'll limp on.
Okay, well, I think summer election if he gets absolutely pummeled, because there's no way that he's going to be able to survive beyond the autumn, and he certainly doesn't want to be facing a Conservative Party conference, in my opinion, if he's limping on as the way a really bad night on Thursday would inevitably result in. So we will see. We will see. He may be doing better than people anticipate. He may be taking some comfort and some motivation from the fantastic performance, I have to say, over the past 7 days of my football club, Everton, who, despite an 8-point deduction from the corrupt Premier League, despite the fact that we've had injuries galore, and despite the fact that most people in the country thought we were doomed, Sean Dyche has done a tremendous job and has proved that 7 days isn't simply a long time in politics, but can be a long time in football as well. The highlight of three fabulous victories at Goodison Park this week was, of course, the 2-0, the 2-0 success over Liverpool, not simply securing Everton's Premier League status, but sadly, sadly, ended Jurgen Klopp's dream of winning a Premiership title before he goes off and starts to look forward to his trip a lot. Although I'm not sure it's as generous in Germany as it is here in the UK. Anyway, listen, it's been great for having Jim, my partner in crime, back this week. We'll be back next Monday, Bank Holiday Monday special, looking at all those results, thinking about what the implications could be, and seeing whether Plymouth Argyle have survived in the Championship. Have a great week, all. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with the Downtown Then Politics podcast next Monday.